Hi, this is Dick Miller. You're listening to Junk Food Cinema. Who are these guys?
Jump on your jet skis, Junkions. It's time for another deep episode of Junk Food Cinema, brought to you by FilmSchoolRejects.com. Dot, don't eat the squid.
Dot, it's not a jet ski, it's a wave runner.
Wave runners. I know wave runners. What do you want to know?
And it's a callback to last week.
Back. This is the weekly cult and exploitation film cast. So good, it just has to be fattening. I'm your host, Brian Salisbury, and I'm joined, as per usual, by my friend and co-host. He's a novelist, a screenwriter, lieutenant of Megaforce, and if the money's there, he don't care, Mr. C. Robert Cargill.
That's absolutely not true. That last part, no.
I don't know. I saw Sinister 2.
Oh, talk about
Come on, you set it up so well. You put the ball on the tee, and then I feel bad. If it makes you feel better, I feel bad for that one. But this show, I'm super excited about because this is sort of it creates a nice little platter with last week's episode where we talked about two underwater monster movies. And in this week,
three monster movies.
Not to mention that this is also a patron requested episode. So we're
doing a whole month of these, right?
Yes, we are. Yes, we are. And I want to remind you guys again that if you want to get on board this train, you can go to patreon.com/junkfoodcinema and for $25 an episode. And if you commit to that for a whole month, that's four episodes. So basically
For a Benjamin.
For a Benjamin.
You get to call the shot.
You tell us exactly what to cover, and we do it.
This is not, by the way, like a food dare. This is not a ha-ha-ha, cover this. We really would like you to ask us for things you'd really like us to talk about that we would hopefully enjoy.
See, that's the thing, is everyone who's requested a movie, and by the way, I have to say huge thanks because I did not expect so many people to jump on this, and we're now having to take a whole month. And then even after that, we may have to do it again in a few weeks after that. So many people jumped on this train and really were super generous. And the movies that they're picking, I feel like a couple of them are going to feel like that for you and I, but they are genuinely in love with these movies that they are requesting of us. So there has never been a Tontine or a Rochambeau situation of cinema.
Well, you tried that for a while. You did that as a patron exclusive.
Yes.
And that was a terrible mistake.
It was, but I'm going to do that again, by the way. That's the taste test. I'm going to bring that back because actually, it was a real mixed bag, but it did introduce me to things like, I saw somebody tweeting the other day that Sun Ra was having this big reunion concert, and I'm like, oh, from that fucking movie that I had to watch because of the taste test. Hey guys, Brian here from the future! So yeah, I found out shortly after we recorded this that Sun Ra himself is actually dead. So apologies, no disrespect meant. I was unaware of that. His band is actually still touring. All right, cleared that up. Now I will return to the future! Oof, that is a thing. But speaking of things, we are going to, we are on Twitter. I don't know, that's a terrible segue.
That is possibly Weinbergian in its terribleness. Like, that is a segue. That's not a segue, that's a bicycle.
Yeah.
You have to pedal it. No, but it worked.
Oh, you know what it is? It's one of those fucking rent-a-scooters. Can we, early in the show, I don't care. Sidebar. Let's talk about the fucking rent-a-scooters that, while they're annoying in Austin, I went to San Antonio for the weekend. Fucking San Antonio, figure it out.
Figured it.
Whatever the fuck you're doing with these scooters needs to stop. They are everywhere. They are on the lawn of the goddamn Alamo. I had to dodge people going 35 on the sidewalk. I saw someone, I am not kidding, I saw a family steal one of these scooters, load it in the back of their truck, and drive off. Newsflash, it's not gonna fucking work when you get it home. You're not gonna be able to resell it.
They might be taking it there so their kid can ride it to school the next day.
They're stealing it. It was a theft situation. Middle of the night.
All I know about,
they're all over the city. You don't need to transport it from downtown to where you live. They're all over the fucking city.
All I'm going to say is I once took a picture of Elijah Wood riding one of those things, and my Google alerts went off for a week. So, you know, people love Elijah Wood on a lime.
That is is the weirdest in favor argument I have ever heard for scooters.
Did I say I was in favor of it? I said that's the only thing I know about it. Like,
what I know is how to get likes on Twitter.
I've ridden one.
Therefore, scooters.
It went 12 miles an hour. It was fun to tootle around on. I don't know if I would do that normally. I know that I saw them all over Los Angeles. People seem to like them. I do know that there are a series of websites online, like Bird Graveyard, where it's just a bunch of pictures of the horrible things that people have done to these things, because boy, do they fucking destroy them every chance they get.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they're an interesting thing, but I certainly don't have a rant about them. I just, it's just like, all right, it's really fun to watch people ride them.
Figure it out.
Yeah, they should figure it out.
Patron Sam Gregory requested this particular movie.
Hi, Sam.
That we definitely would have covered anyway, but since you're paying us.
That's the thing is, we talked, I've mentioned Leviathan and Deep Star 6 in the past. I've mentioned wanting to do Deep Rising. I mean, of all of Stephen Sommers' films, this is the one that I think is honestly the most fun and that I like the most. I know a lot of people like the Mummy movies better. This is what Stephen Sommers is to me. He seems to be having so much fun making this movie, and makes the hell out of it. So I've been on board for this one for a while and knew we would do it.
So for this episode, we're on a boat and we're talking fast and we got our nautical theme, Peshmina Afghans, because it's Deep Rising.
They answered a distress call.
Where the hell is everybody?
Now. They're dead in the water.
I got a really bad feeling about this.
The ship's infested.
Let's get the hell out of here!
I don't mean to sound like a wuss, but this is starting to freak me out, man.
I vote we leave.
Who votes we leave?
Deep Rising.
Oh my God, so excited to talk about this movie. But first I have to ask you a question. You were wearing a t-shirt for Emily Hagen's Pathogen, which was her first movie.
That is a thing.
Did she intentionally borrow the color scheme and font from a Toblerone candy bar? Because that's entirely what that shirt looks like.
She was 14 years old at the time. That would not shock me.
That's awesome.
Yeah, no, I was in Emily Hagen's first movie. I was the janitor who, the bumbling janitor who accidentally caused zombie geddon, and I got an adorable crew shirt out of it. And sometimes hanging out in my home, I wear my crew shirt.
It's awesome. I love that it is the color and font of a Toblerone candy bar. That's so rad. Anyway, Deep Rising, Stargrove.
Stargrove. Are we ever going to get to Deep Rising?
Eventually. We're talking scooters and Toblerones.
We haven't even done the business yet, have we?
Twitter at Junk Food Cinema, Facebook at Junk Food Cinema.
Patron. If you become a patron, you can force us to watch movies.
I think we covered that in the fact that that's what this is. So we're good. But Stargrove. Deep fucking Rising. Another in the long realm of derelict spacecraft movies. Of course, in this case, the spacecraft is a cruise ship. But why is it? I was wanting to pick your brain a little bit on this, Cargo, because I feel like this is an evergreen central conceit. Like, you could basically make derelict spacecraft movies until the end of time, and they will always engage audiences. Like, it's something that no matter how they play with that, you know, it's very much what we talked about in Leviathan. Not so much Deep Star 6, because that was more of a cave, but with Leviathan, it was a sunken ship. In this movie, it's a cruise ship. Alien obviously is the king of sort of derelict spacecraft movies, but what is it about that type of film that will always keep us coming back?
Well, there are two things to it. Actually, I would argue three things. One, it's essentially a haunted house movie.
Correct.
Like it is, I know.
Ding, correct. I'm scoring this rebuttal, by the way.
Yes, it is, you know, it's essentially a haunted house movie. You know, something weird is going on, something is amiss. And you are going through this creepy, quiet place. Secondly, a derelict spacecraft or a derelict ship, a ghost ship movie, has the added thing of, it's instantly a mystery.
Mm-hmm.
We have found this thing and it is here and it shouldn't be. Why? What happened to everybody? Like, what happened? Like, that is That is just a, first of all, it's a creepy concept, but it's a mystery that we want to see solved. Like, what happened to everyone on the largest cruise ship in history? Like, why is nobody left alive? Why is there one person who's been hiding in a refrigerator? Why is that the only person? Oh, wait, no, there's a few more people in the safe. Why are these the only people left alive? That's a really good question, and we want to find out. And finally, there's just something weird about the fact, like, when you have a large vehicle or you have a house, and it's broken down, it just sits there. It's just sitting. But when you talk about a derelict ship, whether it be space or sea, you've got a vessel, it doesn't just sit there. It's not anchored somewhere. It's going around the world, traveling. There was a famous ghost ship that I think was abandoned in 1938 that has been seen over the years, still just floating around on currents all over the fucking ocean, that just is floating around, and it's out there, and it's just there. Always existing, but never in the same place. And sometimes it just shows up. And that's fucking creepy. It just gets to us. And the fact that it's just this thing kind of going around, like a derelict ship, like in orbit around a sun, would be kind of like an asteroid. But something just adrift in space, just going off, and you never quite know where it is. And when you do run across it, it's not going to be there for very long.
But the fact that it's moving and that it sometimes shows up suggests a level of sentience.
Suggests whether it does or not. Yeah. And that adds a level of fucking creepiness to it. So this is always a really good thing. It's interesting. Steven Sommers talked about making this film. This film got fucked. The Deep Rising was supposed to come out a year earlier. It, because of problems with their special effects department, and we'll get more into this later, it ended up having a year-long post-production. And when they made this movie, nobody had made a ship movie in a long time. It was a new idea, not a new idea, but a fresh idea, something that hadn't been addressed. And by the time this came out, Titanic and Ghost Ship had already come out. And this movie was coming off in the wake of a bunch of different ghost or boat-related things and monster movies, to where it just felt like a knockoff of everything else that had come before it. And it tanked at the box office.
I'm going to be real with you. Of the three movies you just mentioned, Deep Rising is the one I'm going to revisit every single time. Because Ghost Ship is awful.
Oh, Ghost Ship's terrible.
Awful.
Ghost
Ship has barely a movie.
Ghost Ship has one great moment, and that is the scene where the cable goes across the
dance floor. Which is the first 2 minutes of the movie.
Yes. Everything else after that is unwatchable.
It shoots its load so quickly, and then for the rest of the movie...
It is practically the Brian Salisbury of movies.
Hey-o. Pregnant on the second try. The thing is, you're right. It like, all of the goodwill of that movie, and it struggles...
So 4 minutes in?
Yeah. It struggles to capture anything as good as that for the rest... In fact, the rest of it struggles to look like a movie. It's out of focus. It's like...
By the way, Ghost Ship... A film we'll never watch.
Never.
This might be the only time we ever mention.
Put your goddamn drinks down. That's not happening.
Drinks, you say?
There it is. I will go back to Deep Rising before I'll go back to Titanic.
I watched Deep Rising twice this weekend. Like, and didn't even feel bad about it. Like, I ain't even mad. like, fuck yeah. And we'll get into why Deep Rising is so good. Deep Rising is everything Steven Sommers does well in his career, executed wonderfully despite his problems.
Yeah.
And it's a movie that got fucked that shouldn't have gotten fucked. It's a movie that you... Oh, that was the other thing you mentioned. Because the other thing that happened is Anaconda had come out before this was released. So you've got Ghost Ship, Anaconda, and Titanic all out before the movie with a giant sea monster on a boat. He's like, everybody was already tired of all the things he did.
Yeah.
And frankly, several of them did certain elements of those better in their own ways. Like, once you've seen the Titanic sink, watching this ship, like, the mayhem go on with that, it's not quite the same. Well, I'm wondering, did this come out before or after Hard Rain? Because when we're talking wave runners running around in hallways...
Because apparently we can't say jet ski. So when we're talking wave runner...
Something I also learned from the... It was a running joke in the commentary on this
movie. A wave running joke?
The fact that somebody, Steven Sommers' jet skis, and his editor is like, actually, those are wave runners.
Oh my God.
And so I just found it funny that It's true, because jet skis are apparently the ones you stand up on, and the ones you sit down on are called wave runners, but everybody calls them jet skis, even though they're wave runners.
You know, the inventor of a jet ski died because he fell into a cistern. Oh, wait, no, it was a well, actually.
Boo!
Boo! I regret nothing!
Where are they coming from?
I don't know, sir, but whatever it is, it's big.
Let's, Jürgen, pause now. I'm curious. Let's check out the release dates to see if this even...
Versus Hard Rain?
Versus Hard Rain. January 30th, 1998.
This had to come out after Hard Rain then. Because Hard Rain came out the beginning of 98.
That's January 30th of 98. This may be...
This is also 98, so unless it came out in the...
Oh, wait. January 16th, 1998.
Oh, you are shitting me.
Two weeks before this movie came out, we've got wave runners going through hallway school.
Fucking sidebar. Why are both of these movies coming out in January? Why are neither of those movies summer movies?
Because the studios didn't have... Well, first of all, with this one, it's because it was delayed so long.
Okay.
Here you have a movie... well, let's just get into that before we get into everything else. So what happened with this movie is the post-effects studio that had to work on this and create the monsters... or monster. They're never quite 100% clear whether it's monster or monsters.
I always thought it was a nest of one organism but then again, each individual tentacle seems to be sentient.
We see the giant thing, but are those baby things at certain times? I don't know. It's never really explained, which is also cool.
I do know that it's a giant Otoya, which is a giant underwater worm.
Yes.
That is all that I know, because Dr. Childress from Silence of the Lambs tells me that's what's going on.
Yes. So the effects studio, whatever which ones they hired, could not manage it. They could not figure it out. And so ILM slotted them some time. And now keep in mind, Industrial Light and Magic, in 97... while they are prepping and doing work for Phantom Menace, cuts some time out to fucking make the monsters here. And for a 20-year-old CG monster effect, it's fucking great. The design is fucking cool. Designed by Rob Bottin, right?
That's the thing. And this is what I really want to talk about, because I feel like the only shortcoming of this movie, and I'm going to disagree with you a little bit, I think the CG in this movie is not good. It's not the design. You are absolutely correct. The design of the monster is phenomenal. The CG in this movie at points is so honky-tonk.
Well, it's dated because it's literally 20-year-old CG.
But as you just mentioned, Titanic, using the same CG, managed to do okay a year before this. Well, Jurassic Park, 4 years before this, or 5 years before this, did pretty well with its CG.
Well, because that's mostly practical augmented.
This is what I'm saying. It's not a dated thing. It's not because of the era. It's because of shortcuts. And if Rob Bottin had been allowed to do this practically as he wanted, if the studio hadn't decided that they were going to hack that budget in half, I feel like this would be on the level of a Leviathan or Deep Star 6 in terms of its monster creation.
That's fair. And in fact, let's point out that we just talked about two underwater movies released in 99. Or 89. This is 98. And I would argue that, yeah, the effects in both of those movies are better than the monster.
Because they're done practically. And if they had let... And that's what fucking burns my ass about this movie, is that they had Rob Bottin to do the practical effects. Summers wanted to do it practically. And I feel like this might have been his Kenner moment. And I use that term. That's a term that I use when I feel like a director has lost part of himself. And it's in reference to when Kenner came to George Lucas and said, you know these reptile men on the moon of Endor, what do you call them, Ewoks? You know they'd sell a lot better if they were cuddly.
Yeah, we've got these designs. Here's what you'd make with reptile carnivorous creatures, and here's what you'd make with these.
And Kenner, like fucking the devil coming to Faust, is like, how about you just sell out and make them teddy bears?
The rumor that I've heard for years was that was the moment that his wife decided to leave Lucas. That once she saw that he wasn't an artist anymore and he was just selling toys to kids, that she wasn't in love with him and she started fucking the painter.
Dude, where is that movie? Where is that the movie about that particular moment?
He's going to need to die first. He's still...
He's going to need to die first.
Like, we're going to have to lose George before we get to make a movie about why George's sellout point cost him his marriage. And I don't know if that's a movie I want to watch.
You know what? Fair enough. But just the idea of, like, an artist having that one moment in his life. You don't even have to make it specifically George Lucas, but kind of base it on that. The idea of an artist who has that moment where it's like, I can get everything I've ever worked for in terms of the success, but I have to compromise everything about it. It is a modern Faust story. So I feel like Stephen Sommers may have lost something in himself when he was forced to abandon all these practical effects. Because when you watch the Mummy movies, as much as I love the Mummy movies, the CG in those movies is always the weak point.
I do love that when you go on IMDb for this movie, three of the big movies that it recommends are Leviathan, Deep Star 6, and Deep Blue Sea.
There you go. By the way, we didn't mention it last week because I fucking forgot. Leviathan and Deep Star 6, one is 99 minutes, one is 98. They even almost have identical run times.
There's so much in common to those movies, it's not even funny.
It's like a Patty Duke show where, you know, one cousin is Leviathan and the other is Deep Star 6. Ask your parents.
Let's jump off from that because, by the way, this movie, not another movie you're going to find that's totally like it.
Like, no.
Like, the choices it makes here, the actual story, when I tell you the backstory that doesn't involve the monsters, if I just told you that without the monster, you'd be like, wait, what fucking movie is that? What movie has a bunch of mercenaries hire a boat to go out to rob a cruise ship and then sink it? Like, what fucking movie is that? Oh, yeah. No, you've seen this movie.
Yeah.
It's called Deep Rising.
Well, let's also talk about the fact that we talked about the structure of a derelict spacecraft movie where the mystery is what the fuck happened. This movie shows you kind of what happened. And yet still engaged. Like, I need more. I need more information about this. But you see basically everyone on the ship die before our protagonists arrive in the first place.
But we don't know how they die.
We don't know exactly
why they die. Yeah. We don't know what the thing is. We just know that whatever it is, it's ugly, it's gross, and it can kill you from a toilet.
We do know that you are not safe sitting on the toilet. You will have an Elvis death.
So before we go further, we should talk about this incredible fucking cast.
Yeah, again, put on your bibs, Junkions.
Like, these are a bunch of people from Mount Junkmore, most of whom are best beloved here in these halls for playing villains.
Yes.
Like, this is a cast of people who mostly play villains, all put together, and really butting heads with one another in a way they really should. And that's what's really interesting about this movie. This movie is very 50s B-movie in its characters butting heads against each other.
You know what? I just ran down the list, and you're so right.
Yeah.
Every single actor that was on my list is their my favorite role of theirs is a movie where they play the villain.
Yeah. No, and that's what's so great about them. Like, these are all people who are great villains or are consistently cast as villains, especially in this era. So let's talk about the one who is the villain in one of your favorite movies, hands down. A movie that we covered years ago, and probably you will force me to cover two or three more times.
You know what? It's always a treat. Always a treat to talk about this actor.
It's always a William to talk about this treat.
Treat Williams.
Treat Williams. I am Godzilla, and you are Japan. Treat Williams.
Treat Williams. Show me the power. Show me the power. Oh my God, I love him.
Femke Janssen.
Best known for playing the villain in GoldenEye.
To
my heart, beloved to my heart for playing the villain in GoldenEye.
Yes, I would also argue that most people know her as Jean Grey, the least Jean Grey possible. Like, I love Femke Janssen, not so much a fan of her.
She was, incidentally, almost not cast in this movie because the producers were worried she was too recognizable after GoldenEye, and the original actress cast was Claire Forlani. Who did not work out because she disagreed with Stephen Sommers about a lot of things and left, and they brought on Famke Janssen.
By the way, at this time in the 90s, Claire Forlani would have been enough to get me through the door. Like, there's a group of us Gen Xers who we were so madly in love with Claire Forlani for the few films that she had done that just, wait, there's a new Claire Forlani monster movie? I'm in. Like, she had that little bit of clout to be able to do that, but that was the last bit of clout she had, and then she was gone and she made a bad Jackie Chan movie and that was the last we heard.
I was going to say, like, I was going to make a reference to The Usual Suspects, like that. She's gone, and then I realize how many real villains are actually involved in Usual Suspects. So, just gonna move on from that. And
Anthony Held,
Dr. Chilton from Silence of the Lambs is probably what 99% of people know him
from.
But
you know him from a bunch of stuff. The one who you don't know as a villain, Kevin J. O'Connor, who's just a Stephen Sommers regular.
Disagree. Really? He plays a great villain in that first Mummy movie. He's a great little constant antagonist to Brendan Fraser throughout the entire film.
Oh, I guess he is technically a villain in that one.
I feel like is technically in that movie because of his work in this with Stephen Sommers.
No. He was in that because he and Stephen Sommers are good friends and he always wants to work with him.
But he's been in a couple of junk food movies, including Virtuosity.
Yes. Yeah, no. Wes Studi, of course.
Oh my God, Wes, how much do I love Studi. This man? Oh, I love this man so much.
Dude, he's the only one who's he out alphas Treat Williams.
He is the kind of guy, this is what I love about Wes Studi. He is the kind of guy who will be in great movies like Last of the Mohicans and Heat, and also in movies like, and Dances with Wolves, obviously, yeah. But also be in movies like Street Fighter. Yeah. I fucking love Wes Studi for that.
Wes Studi, one of the great character actors of our time. Every time he shows up, it's a treat. It's a super treat here because he really is. He is given his time to shine, and he does not pass up on a moment of it. Okay, then we have Jason Fleming.
Yep.
In what is like his first role or his second
very,
role?
Very early. This would have been post... or the same year as Lockstock. So, yeah, early in his career. In fact,
he talked about it was released in the same year as Lockstock, but again, it sat on a shelf for a year while they did post. And then, of course, you would actually, even though he's in Lockstock, you know him even better in Snatch as the shaved head Pikey who sells his...
The trailer.
Sells the trailer. Yeah. But you know him in a bunch of things.
Layer Cake.
One of my favorites, someone I've been trying to work with for years, Cliff Curtis.
Oh, yeah.
Cliff Curtis is a Maori man who gets cast as Arabs. That is how fucked up Hollywood has been.
Or, if you're in Training Day, a Mexican.
Yes.
Because why not? No, he's fucking great. And it was funny watching this movie again and just marveling at this cast and going, oh, this tiny mercenary role amongst all these other recognizable mercenaries is Cliff Curtis. Like, are you fucking serious?
But the great thing, they let him be Maori.
Yes.
Like, it's for the 90s, that's woke as fuck. Like, to borrow from Joseph Kahn, that's, you know, it in that era, you know, because this is the same around the same time that he was an Arab in Collateral Damage. Was it Collateral Damage?
Yes, yeah. No, it was Collateral Damage. You're right.
Because isn't he also in True Lies?
No, that's a different actor. But you're on the right track.
Yeah, no, he's done.
But he's also in Lee Tamahori's Once for Warriors, which is the like defining Maori movie.
Yes, well, that's the thing is that he's the recognizable actor who's worked in the U.S. and in Europe, who then can do films in New Zealand, and there he's a star because he's acted with everybody.
Yeah, I also want to point out that I was watching this movie tonight, and my stepson goes, "Oh, that's the guy from The Meg," and I was like, he's not in The Meg. And then I looked it up. Oh, he's definitely in The Meg. My stepson fucking remembered Cliff Curtis from The Meg, and I didn't remember he was in
it. I haven't seen The Meg, and after all these, I think that's what I need to watch.
It's fun. Tonight. It's so much
that's
fun.
That's what everybody says. I've been meaning to watch it, but that's what everyone says. It's exactly what you think it is. And I'm like, great. The night that I'm prepped for that, that is what I'm going to sit down and watch.
The trailers aren't lying to you. Let me just put it to you that way.
Then you've got Trevor Goddard, who is the guy that I mentioned last week in passing, who... died tragically at the age of 40.
Oh, wow.
Like, it was...
Is he the Australian mercenary?
Yes. Okay. Yeah. He's the one that you haven't seen since because he died shortly after... He died in 2003. So he's been gone for 15 years. But he had a very short... But we know him. He's a junk food alum. He's fucking Kano from Mortal Kombat.
Oh, my God. So you have Kano from Mortal Kombat and Sagat from Street Fighter in the same fucking movie?
Yes.
I just got so hard.
I told you that
this table might tip over.
Every Everyone in this movie has played a great villain in a movie we love. Like, this is a cast of villains playing fucking villains put in a fucked up situation. There are no heroes in this movie, by the way. The only person you could argue is kind of not a villain in this movie is Kevin J. O'Connor.
Yeah.
Kevin J. O'Connor is the mechanic for a shady Merc transport service.
If the money's there, we don't care.
And so he's kind of not cool with that, but he's also kind of really cool with that.
Speaking of, patreon.com/junkfoodcinema.
Yeah. If the money's there,
we don't care.
I you know what? I care. I can pick a good movie, guys.
Seriously. Like Deep Rising, for example. Like,
so far, the two that you presented me, I'm like, fuck yeah, guys. I was a little shaky on the last one. What was the one we did?
Stone Cold.
Oh. But watching it again, I really enjoyed it. So I was really happy that panned out that way. But guys, movies that you think we'd
oh, this is going to get interesting.
Okay, Jaimon Hunsu.
Oh my God, yes.
And this is the era when he was just coming up. This is the era when he gave one of my favorite quotes of all time in an interview, in which he was asked shortly thereafter, about a year later, he was in Legionnaire.
Mm-hmm.
And he was asked, so you're also in this movie Legionnaire with Jean-Claude Van Damme, which is going direct to video. And he goes, yeah, but that's not my fault. was, like, of all the directions you could have taken that, Jaimon Hunsu goes, yeah, but that's not because of me.
Also, 2 years, I'm just going to point this out, 2 years after Deep Rising, he's in a Best Picture. So you know what? Jaimon Hunsu was well on his way at this
also,
point.
Also, interesting thing, there's a character in this called Billy. Who's played by Clint Curtis, no relation.
Just so you know,
the white guy and the Maori guy, not related.
By the way, have you ever heard Jaimon Hunsu's whole story? Because it's fucking fascinating.
I've heard parts of it.
So he moved to Paris at 13, just on his own, to find work. He was unable to find work, ended up homeless, sleeping under bridges. And then he was discovered by fashion designer Thierry Mugler, who made him a model. And then he became an actor because of that. So he's literally plucked off the streets, becomes a model, and then becomes an actor. And now is in every fucking franchise you can possibly name.
Not only has he shown up in the Marvel Universe, he's coming back in 2 months in Captain fucking Marvel.
Nice.
I'm a little stoked. I don't know if I've told this publicly, the story publicly before, but that was the movie that I pitched to Kevin and said, hey, if you're looking for a writer
for Captain Marvel,
I know you guys are making a Captain Marvel movie. I would love, and Kevin was just like, are you a woman?
And I was good, like, for him. No. I'm sorry it didn't work out for
you.
But good for him.
I consider that the one job I'm the happiest that I got turned down for, because that's the greatest excuse, where Marvel's like, no, we really need more women writing movies for us. I'm like, fuck yeah, you do. Let's go.
Also, one of the rare breed that transcends both Marvel and DC is he's also an Aquaman.
I haven't seen Aquaman yet, but
I haven't either, but he's on the fucking IMDb for it. So good for you, man. IMDb. Yeah.
So I'm really kind of fucking stoked. But yeah, so that is a fucking rogues gallery of fucking rogues.
Yeah.
And by the way, there's no one else. There is no hero to anchor to. We have a group of people who do transporting shady shit and asking no questions. We've got a group of fucking mercenaries armed with torpedoes who are going out to a fucking cruise ship. We've got a rogue captain.
A sleazeball
cruise line owner who has gotten himself in too deep and has sabotaged his own ship in order for the insurance money. That goes terribly wrong. And then our only other character is a fucking thief.
Yeah.
Who is fucking robbing everybody on this fucking cruise ship. There are no good guys. This is what is so great about this, and what Steven Sommers does best is he presents us with a bunch of shit smears, and they are such fascinating shit smears that we want to watch them try to get off a ship alive that a giant fucking monster is on.
It's hard to argue that this cast isn't stacked when they've got so many people that they can kill Jaimon Hunsu before the monster even kills people. Like, Jaimon Hunsu doesn't even die because of the monster. That's how many people they have to ready and to play in this game.
Again, along with these other movies, this is the one where this movie does diverge a lot from the previous two films. In that we do see the monster kill a bunch of people early on. We don't see what it is. We don't know what's killing people. We just know something's killing people. And we know something has gone terribly wrong, and it has a huge body count. That said, our characters interacting with the monster itself doesn't happen until a little later in the movie.
54 minutes.
54 minutes in.
Pretty much halfway through.
Before the monster shows up and it ends up being the monster movie. And the rest of that, by the way, is jam-packed with character interactions. The plot is so simple. It's literally just characters butting heads with one another in the most fascinating ways. It's why this movie is such a rewatchable film. Again, when you take great characters and put them on screen and give them the slightest interesting things to do and at halfway decent stakes, the audience will be glued. And when you have character actors like this who are rarely, like, this is the thing to keep in mind. Part of the reason I think this movie works so well is that these are all actors who are very rarely given things to do in movies, and they are the fucking leads. Like, yeah, Treat Williams is technically the lead of the movie. He doesn't particularly have more to do in the movie than anyone else. He's our strong-jawed hero. Oh, sidebar. There was a moment in this movie that in rewatching it, I was like, oh, this is the most Brian moment ever in a movie. We have a movie with an actual Chekhov's gun. Set off the alarms. There is a shot of Treat Williams sitting in a seat. We cut to the back of the seat. There is a gun. Will that gun come into play? Yes, it will.
It's like the fucking boomstick in Army of Darkness, man.
It is a Chekhov's gun moment. And as much as you love Chekhov's gun,
I love it.
Holy shit. This is an actual Chekhov's gun. Will that come in later, useful later? Yes, it will.
It's a trope that, like, I feel like most people don't give a shit about in movies that just makes me so happy.
It's a rule. Yeah. It's like, it's storytelling 101. Do not have to explain the joke as the joke is happening. Explain the setup of the joke, then let the punchline come and have everyone go, oh, I get that. Oh, I know where that gun came from. In the commentary for this, they actually talk about Stephen Sommers' biggest pet peeve in movies. And he actually has this once in this movie. His biggest pet peeve is 80-yard lines to explain shit to the audience.
Oh, yeah.
After a test screening. So whenever they cut to the back of an actor's head and you hear a line, that's his pet peeve. And he has one here. And they could not remember because they did the... By the way, for those of you that are interested in this film, those of you that are excited about this film, Kino Lorber put out a beautiful Blu-ray of it just 6 months ago.
We have a mutual friend who introduced me to that website recently. And I really wish he hadn't. Because oh my god! Because I used to review stuff for Kino, and they would only
you have kids, man. You can't afford
I
that.
I know, and
you
they
can't
would,
afford that addiction.
They would only send me their like 60s horror line of movies that they made, and I was like, okay, some of these are decent, but most of them I'm like pass. And then I found out how many movies they have actually put out on Blu-ray that are, let's just say, in keeping with core values of junk food cinema. So now every time they have a fucking sale, I'm like, ooh, I might need that White Lightning Blu-ray.
Did you see the cover of this Blu-ray?
Oh, yes, I did.
The artwork they did for this? So there's no poster that was as cool as that.
If you were to look at this Blu-ray cover, you would swear it was Scream Factory. Like, that's how much care went into the design of this cover art.
If that had been the poster, this movie would not have bombed.
I agree 1,000%.
Also, I'm thinking January 1998, maybe not a good month for movies in terms of box office.
Maybe because you released them in goddamn fucking January.
Also true. Because that's the thing is, this is the second movie we've done in less than a year from this particular month.
Yeah.
And they're both fucking good. And they both have wave runners going through Hollywood.
Oh, you mean jet skis?
Also, I need to point out, this movie has the 90s trifecta.
Oh, bring it on.
This is the 90s trifecta. There is a thing about 90s filmmaking that we don't often talk about. It is every decade has its bad thing,
mm-hmm.
has its cancer.
Sure.
And you see the cancer of the 90s leaking out into the aughts. It still exists into the aughts, but it came from the 90s. And it is people running down hallways, outrunning forces of nature. And this movie has all three. We are outrunning water in hallways. We are outrunning explosions and fire in hallways.
Yep, yep.
And we are outrunning monsters in hallways. Like, we are outrunning things that we have no reason to, no right to be able to outrun, especially, have you ever tried to walk through a shoreline of water? Imagine being waist deep and trying to outrun anything, let alone an explosion, but the do it.
I'm going to completely back you up on this, because the two worst examples in the 2000s, long past when this trope should have died, are legendarily bad. The first being The Day After Tomorrow, where they outrun global warming.
Close the door!
They outrun the freezing of the, a flash freeze.
They are chased by global warming down a hallway. The second being in The Happening, where they are chased by wind.
Let's just stay ahead of the wind. Here it comes!
And they somehow win. Like, they somehow win the foot race with wind. So the two worst examples of that in the 2000s illustrate the fact that that should have died off in the 90s.
It's really a very bad trope, and it exists in so many movies. We talked about it last week, or not last week, I'm sorry, last month. We had one example of that in a Shane Black movie.
Yes.
In The Long Kiss Goodnight. And it leads to a very cool moment. But, you know, that's how prevalent it was, that Shane Black had done in 95. Here we are, 4 years later, Stephen Sommers, not out just outrunning fire, they're also going to outrun water, and they're going to outrun monsters. And there's no reason they should outrun any of them, but they always do.
So I want to talk about this monster for a second, because that is one of my very favorite parts of this movie, is the concept of this monster, which is that, for all intents and purposes, it's an octopus. It has a central core, and then it has all of these tentacles, but each individual tentacle...
I want to put my tentacles all over you.
Stop saying that to me. Each individual tentacle has teeth, has a seemingly a motivation. It is strange.
Are they all tentacles, though, or are they separate? That's the thing. This movie never explains whether that's a bunch of... like, if there's a bunch of smaller ones and just one big one, or if it's just one big one spreading out through the ship.
And because there is something so horrific about not knowing exactly all the dimensions of this thing, it reminds me a lot of Lovecraft. It reminds me a lot of a monster that is so nightmarish that it will drive you mad, and trying to decipher exactly where one part ends and another begins is part of the madness that you will succumb to. Like, there's something very Cthulhu about this thing that takes over the ship.
Well, and I don't think that's an accident. That's the thing about Stephen Sommers. And Stephen Sommers is one of the great schlock directors. And I don't mean that in an insulting way. He's the guy you get to make the fun tongue-in-cheek monster movies. The fun family monster movies, or in this case, just over-the-top monster movies that harken back to an age. He's a director much like we've talked about in the past with people like Fred Decker, who are obsessed with a certain era or a certain type of movie. And Stephen Sommers is very much obsessed with the old kind of 50s monster movie aesthetics. And what he does best is makes fun, campy, you're allowed to laugh and have a good time with it because this is to entertain you, monster movies. And so he totally goes full into that, but he also draws from Lovecraft. Like, this whole concept of this monstrous thing, you don't need to fully understand it because the point is it's a fucking monster and mercenaries are going to run from it and try to shoot it and people are going to die in awful ways. That's the fucking point. And so he's going to explain it just enough and leave the rest to your imagination and have fun. And that's what this movie is.
And a common thing we've talked about with the two movies last week and the movie this week is how much they are cribbing from Alien. This one more so from Aliens with the mercenaries. They're not specifically sent in to deal with this problem. They don't know this problem exists. But it is a team of mercenaries dealing with the monster. So it more resembles Aliens.
It has that. There is one moment where he actually, Stephen Sommers, makes a direct reference to Aliens, in which we've got Femke Janssen, she's wearing a white tank top, she's carrying a gun, she's wading into the water, you got the big red light circling in the background in the very same way that Cameron had in Aliens. Like, it just, like, it look, it's like, you know, this is the moment where he was like, oh yeah, no, this is my Alien show.
Right.
But the movie does not lift from that. The movie borrows more from old island monster movies of the 50s and of the 30s. It is very much a cliffhanger kind of movie than it is anything directly recent. Like, he was trying to make something that was nostalgic and a throwback, which, by the way, in the 90s was not cool.
Oh, we're going to talk about what this movie was supposed to be very shortly, because it is fucking fascinating. Because in the last 5 minutes of this movie, you realize... We'll get there. I'm sorry. I'm so excited.
The final shot of this movie?
I'm talking about the final shot of this movie and what this was supposed to lead into that now bleeds into what we are experiencing right this fucking second in cinema and how they're connected in the most unexpected way imaginable. Anywho, I want to talk for just a second about the fact that while we love Treat Williams in the role of Finnegan, the original actor offered the role was Harrison Ford.
I got a really bad feeling about this.
I have a really bad feeling about this.
In the litany of ways that this movie got fucked, the first of those was that when Harrison Ford passed, they cut its budget tremendously because they realized they didn't have a tentpole star like Harrison Ford.
I can't see this movie having ever gotten made with Harrison Ford.
Oh, no. But the thing is, when Harrison Ford passed... this was made by Hollywood Pictures, which, for those of you who don't know, was a subsidiary of Disney.
Yeah, it was Disney's adult movie shingle. Like, essentially, anything that was intended for mature audiences that wasn't a family film went under Hollywood Pictures.
So, Stephen Sommers began writing the script that he called Tentacle in the mid-90s, and it was geared for release at that time. However... In 1997, Hollywood Pictures had a lot more faith in a little movie called Con Air. So they kind of put Deep Rising on the back burner, or Tentacle on the back burner became Deep Rising.
Why wouldn't you have faith in Con Air?
No, I get that.
Why have we not done Con Air?
Because we are terrible people, and I don't know what to tell you. Like, there's no excuse for it.
There's no excuse why we've not done Con Air.
Hey, if you want to give us $25 an episode for... No, we're going to cover Con Air. Like, take all of the drinks imaginable. Because, again, huge fucking cast... on a vehicle, something goes wrong. It's very much in keeping with what we're talking about. So Harrison Ford says no. They want to put more effort and attention to Con Air. Like, I feel like this movie is just getting fucked left and right for things that has nothing to do with it. But one of the only things that audiences had a problem with in terms of the test screening of Deep Rising was that they liked Kevin J. O'Connor's character so much that when he died in the original cut of this movie, they threw a fit. They're like, we don't like that at all.
You know what? I've always felt that's what happened, and they don't talk about that at all
in the commentary.
So I was like, oh shit, I've always thought this was one of those, hey, we killed this guy, but it turns out it's not really that. And he was meant to just disappear for a while and then he comes back. It's great. No, that makes total sense because you know what? That is He's a character that you expect dies.
But he's so great. Can we talk about how great he is in this movie?
He's really, like, he has the joke that everyone remembers this film for. If you don't remember any other scene in this movie, you remember the girl from Ipanema Gag. Like,
oh, that. I didn't even think that was the one you were going with. That's how many moments I think he has in this movie.
Yeah, no, but that is like the tentpole moment of this movie, the centerpiece, the piece de resistance is, you know, them when they're on the elevator. Da, 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 da.
What the hell is that? Girl from Ipanema.
Those of you who have been listening to me podcast for about 15 years now have heard me do Girl from Ipanema, and I'm always referencing Deep Rising, even if I don't say it. Like, that's the whole reason I do it, is that thing. It's like, what the hell is this? And he goes, I think it's Girl from Ipanema, and clearly he's not talking about that. And then they're wading through the water, like, 5 minutes later, he's like, bah, ba-da, ba-da, ba-ba-ba-da. And he's like, I can't get that song out of my head. And that is just such a great humanizing moment that's cute and adorable and clever. And is just so well executed. And that moment just punctuates. But he has so many great moments in this
movie. I'm going to tell you now my favorite Kevin J. O'Connor moment in this movie, which is the one I thought you were talking about, was he and Wes Studi are running down a hallway, and they're running from the monster. Yes. And Wes Studi says, the only way to slow it down is to feed it. And he's like, I only have a breath mint and a stick of gum. What do we feed it? Wes Studi takes out his gun and shoots Kevin J. O'Connor in the leg, intending to sacrifice him to the monster so he can get away. It doesn't happen. And then later when they cross paths again, Wes Studi is being devoured by the monster. And Kevin J. O'Connor starts to run away and then gives Wes Studi the gun so he can kill himself to spare himself the agony and says, "Don't say I never gave you nothing." And then as he's running away, Wes Studi tries to shoot Kevin J. O'Connor instead.
Yeah, fuck that guy.
He's like, "You're an asshole." And he runs away. And then Wes Studi goes to kill himself and the gun is empty.
I think of that as a Wes Studi moment, not like a Kevin J. O'Connor
moment. That's true. That's true.
It's more Wes Studi's, you know, payoff and ending. Like, Wes Studi deserved to die that way horribly because of the shitty thing he did. I thought you were talking about the great moment where Wes Studi starts pulling out grenades and Kevin J. O'Connor just takes one and throws it. And then Wes Studi gives him a look and pulls
the pin. Doesn't pull the fucking pin.
You didn't tell me I was supposed to pull the
pin.
Oh,
my God.
Which, by the way, that gets paid off later because that grenade then goes off later.
Dude, it's Chekhov's grenade.
There's so much Jackoffs going on here.
Chekhov's grenade.
Hey, Chekhov's gun. So this is... This movie sets up and pays off all of these moments so well over the course of the movie. But yeah, no, I was convinced that this had to be a movie. Like, there's another movie. I don't know if we'll ever cover it or not. I need to revisit it. I remember kind of not liking it at the time, but several people did. Wing Commander. I'm thinking that is a no.
Here's what I will say. The diplomatic answer is I will have to revisit.
I will have to revisit it. But yeah, it's clear and obvious that one of our favorites now I'm blanking on a serial killer, Matthew Lillard. Lillard. Matthew Lillard clearly dies in that movie, and then the test audience didn't like it, so they saved him, and he survives in the most ludicrous, where it's like, what are you still doing? You're like, oh, hey, this crazy thing happened. It was the weirdest fucking thing.
I will say this. It's not the worst video game movie adaptation I've ever seen, if that helps the argument at all. By the way, we have not mentioned this. Huge carryover from last week. The only place where the Venn diagram here is purple, score by Jerry Goldsmith.
Jerry Goldsmith having lots of fun with this, like 10 years later, being like, hey, I could score an aquatic movie. That'll be fun. I love those.
He's really good at creating atmosphere. And it's interesting because this feels like a very old Hollywood, grandiose 30s type score. You know, all of the dramatic moments, all of the scares have the big horn section blaring up. In Leviathan, he is doing something that at points is very synth, which is different and weird for Jerry Goldsmith.
Yeah, but that synth in Leviathan, I wish we had talked about it last week, is so fucking
cool. Oh, it's great. It's
like,
so
it's
great.
Like, it's so synth wave in the, just the, he's got these really great stabs that are,
yes,
just like, holy shit, that's cool. Like, that feels gritty and raw in the right way for this scene. Like, it's genius.
Which maybe should have tipped us off that it was 2027 that fucking Goldsmith is doing synthwave. Like, but I don't know. I guess I missed that part. I guess the kills in this movie are all fantastic. I like the way that the monster is able to kind of crash move down hallways. Like, it really like fills that entire hallway and is like stumbling all over itself. And even though there are moments where it looks like it's swallowing Sims characters because it's super CGI, I think Jason Fleming has a pretty incredible death in this movie.
Yeah, he also has the only dumb death in the movie, where there's a moment where, like, he's fighting the thing, and it goes down a tube, and then he turns off the fire that's actually keeping the thing down the tube, and then the thing comes and eats him.
Well, no, I actually read it as he chases one up the chimney and then thinks he's safe, and another fucking one is waiting in the room because there are so many of these goddamn tentacles.
That's possible.
Because it's like, literally, he's like, he thinks he's safe, and then it's like, he turns around, and, oh shit, there's another one, and it swallows him like a Sims character. It bothers me a little bit that this could have been another Botine, like, masterful creation.
Could, but at the same time, they were having problems with Botine. It's like, there was a moment where that Summers talks about where he needed a piece of rubber, essentially just a piece of pipe, to fly in front of the screen, just go pff, real quick. Because they needed to make it look like a tentacle was coming. And he's like, I just need this thing to go across. It's going to be a quick, where it's going to be on screen for half a second. I just need this thing. It took him 6 weeks, and they brought 6 crates to assemble this little cannon that shoots this really amazingly designed tentacle across the screen. And you can't tell what the fuck it is. You would think it may have been a quick CGI thing. It could have been anything shot across screen. He spent 6 weeks building this practical effect that you barely see. Now, that's how great Rob Bottin is, but could Rob Bottin have delivered this in any kind of time? I don't know. Like, as dedicated to that and as many creature effects as was in this, would they have been able to go as big as they did with that? I don't know.
You can't do that unless you have Harrison Ford money. You can't be wasting
Harrison Ford money. You could have done that. Yes, they didn't have Harrison Ford money. They had Treat Williams money, This is shot a year after Things to Do in Denver When You're Dead.
Why did you have to? Why?
Because that's Treat Williams.
I don't hate that movie. I also recognize that it's a terrible movie. So it's rough for me because I saw that during I was in high school. I had this super huge mafia kick where I would watch any mafia movie imaginable. And I will say that in 2019, or I guess in 2018 when it was released, it did give me the foresight to know that the Armando Sani made for HBO Gotti movie is better than the John Travolta Gotti movie by leaps and goddamn bounds.
Now, why'd you have to mention Gotti, the greatest film of 2018?
According to the people who made Gotti and no one else.
I don't know. Nick Robinson seems to like it an awful lot. Nick Robinson.
Nick Robinson.
Our friend Nick
also
Robinson.
Likes medical grade Four Loko. Like I don't.
And Oogie loves Big Balloon Adventure, and he loves all sorts of ironic things.
Nick Robinson is the greatest troll of all time. I'm gonna let you finish. But Nick Robinson is the greatest troll of all time, and he's fucking Miyagi level at trolling. He's great. But no, I'm gonna go ahead and stand firm that Gotti is, for the amount of people who should have known better, it is one of the worst movies of 2018. When you put it in perspective of the ratio of people who are in that movie who should have fucking known better, it's one of the worst movies of 2018. And I know that because HBO in the early 2000s made a movie starring Armando Sante and half the cast of The Sopranos about John Gotti that is infinitely fucking better than Gotti. And it's also called Gotti!
I saw Things to Do in Denver When You're Dead when it came out in theaters, and I liked it. I'm terrified to revisit it because everybody hates it. I hate the last 2 minutes of that movie. You know, boat drinks. Ridiculous.
I'm so glad you remember Boat Drinks. Oh, I thought I was the only person on the planet.
Boat Drinks is the only thing most people remember from that movie. But, like, Treat Williams, like, we are clearly in the sidebar, but let's take a nice trip to the sidebar with a song.
There it is.
And there it is. And Treat Williams, having been a guy in prison who took money to eat people's poo, and the way he talks and like defends it, he's like, it doesn't really have much flavor. It's really just kind of spongy. Like the way he's trying to explain it away. And then when he goes nuts in his apartment, and like I said earlier, you know, I am Godzilla, you are Japan. Like he is out of his fucking mind. He is just having a blast doing that sequence. And it's got, again, a murderer's row, a rogues gallery of some of our favorite actors all doing just really interesting stuff. It's a movie I'm terrified to revisit because I remember loving it like over 2 decades ago. And everybody else since is like, dude, that movie's not good.
You know why you loved it 2 decades ago? Because it was every other Tarantino knockoff that came out after Pulp Fiction.
Yeah, but some of those were really bad. Like 2 Days in the Valley is fucking terrible. The only thing worth even mentioning 2 Days in the Valley for is it had a very young Charlize Theron as the villain. And you could tell she was a star from the moment she walked on screen.
Is there a part of you that watches Things to Do in Denver When You're Dead and you hear that Treat Williams talking about shit and you think maybe what he's talking about is doing The Substitute 4. Maybe when he's talking about eating shit.
You know, the Substitute 4 is rather tasteless. It's really just kind of spongy.
Failure is not an option. Eating shit apparently is The Substitute 4.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not going to defend that movie. I'm just going to say that I really liked it and that I'm terrified to go back and revisit it because I hate to go back and go, shit, do I hate this movie now?
Like, Sponge, do I hate this movie now?
Like, I've had too many of those experiences where it's like, Cargill, don't go back. And I'm like, but I love the barbarians as a kid.
Oh, you're going to turn into a pillar of salt. Stop looking back, man. Stop looking back.
Why did I ever rent that like 18 times from Blockbuster?
Which do you think is better, The Substitute or The Principal? Because The Principal is
Lou Gossett Jr., right?
It has Lou Gossett Jr., but the star of that movie is Jim Belushi. The star of The Substitute is Tom Berenger, then replaced in all of the sequels by Treat Williams.
I don't like... I got to be honest. I don't like either of them.
Good, because that is the correct answer. Okay, good.
Because I was like, shit, I've never liked those. Like, those were series I didn't get. It's kind of, it's like, unlike, like, with Tom Berenger, it's like, I like Sniper, but everything after that, I don't understand why they kept making them. Like, Sniper wasn't a movie, like, I need more of this. No, I really don't. It's like Proof of Life. Like, Proof of Life, the first half of Proof of Life is like, I'm not into this. The second half of Proof of Life, where it's a buddy action movie retrieving a kidnap.
Where it's just Russell Crowe breaking up Meg Ryan's marriage. It's just, the second half of that movie is really interesting.
Yeah, well, when you've got an action movie with Russell Crowe and...
By the way, David Caruso's birthday is today. We are recording this on David Caruso's birthday, so a little shout out to David Caruso. Oh. It's also Nicolas Cage's birthday, so shout out to him as well. Punching women in the face dressed as a bear.
Sometimes I like to light a match and let it burn in my fingers just so I can feel something.
Shoot him again. His soul is still dancing.
But yeah, no, like the second half of that movie where it's just David Caruso and Russell Crowe, like, go on an action movie together. You're like, fuck, I want to watch more of these. Everything with the whole relation, like the breaking up the marriage, yeah, that's fucked. But everything else is like, this is kind of cool. So I feel like that's... Yeah,
there's no real flavor. It's just kind of spongy.
But, yeah, it's just kind of spongy. And we're done with the sidebar. Back to Deep Rising.
Stargrove! Man, that's just real quick. Do you remember Christopher Lloyd's character's name in Things to Do in Denver with Your Dad?
I don't.
Pieces.
That's right.
Because he's got the leprosy. Stargrove! Anyway, so let's...
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, yes. It's one of those nights.
It really is. Let's talk about the ending of this movie, because I am fascinated by what this movie was supposed to be.
Tell me what this movie was supposed to be.
So we get to the end of the movie. Famke Jensen and Treat Williams have done their wave running off of the cruise ship, and they make it to this island they keep seeing off the port bow. And when they make it to the island and Kevin J. O'Connor comes out of the sea, just kidding, I wasn't dead.
Tying that all together, that is that moment where we go behind Held's head and we hear him go, an island, as the island flashes.
Yeah.
So that we could tell the audience, there's an island there.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. So they get to the island. Kevin J. O'Connor's like, just kidding, test audiences, I'm not dead. And then there's a rumbling and a growl in the trees. The trees start shaking. And Treat Williams utters his catchphrase for this movie, which is, now what?
So they're on the island of Lost.
They're on Skull Island. They're on fucking Skull Island. And you're like, holy shit, what is this? But when you watch this movie, you're like, what is this scene? Why is this is so random? When we talk about how there are these giant worms at certain depths of the ocean and what they can do and that they liquefy you and like there's all of these rules and science. And it's crazy, and it's specific to they go in depth at the beginning of this movie. They tell you all about trenches in the South China Sea that you could hide the Himalayas in, and ships go missing all the time. And then all of a sudden, there's King Kong. Like what? It's like literally, I felt like I took mushrooms and they just started to kick in at the end of the movie. I'm like, are they really fucking referencing King Kong? Smash cut to credits. Yeah. They were, because this movie was supposed to be the lead-in to a reboot of King Kong directed by Stephen Sommers. And the reason it didn't happen is because of the lukewarm reception that the Godzilla movie that came out a year, the same year.
97.
Yeah. Or
was it 98?
It might have been the same year, 98. So when that movie bombed, they pulled the plug on it. But we were this fucking close to having exactly the exact cinematic universe that is happening right now started with Kong Skull Island and Godzilla. Now we're doing Godzilla King of the Monsters. Then we're going to do King Kong versus Godzilla. What is happening right now?
I don't know. What is happening right now?
The seeds for that were laid.
Are they making Godzilla movies right now?
They are. And not only that, they're building a cinematic universe out of these monsters again.
I don't know what you're talking about.
I feel like you should know what I'm talking about.
I certainly have not sat in on a scoring session of an upcoming Godzilla movie and watched whole sections of a mind-meltingly fucking cool Godzilla movie that might be coming out soon.
Now, think about the fact that in the year 2000, you could have seen that franchise, that cinematic universe, come to fruition directed by Stephen Sommers. That is fucking fascinating.
That's bonkers. Instead, we got his G.I. Joe movies.
Instead, we got fucking G.I. Joe.
I actually like the first G.I. Joe.
Second one's better.
Dude.
Second one's better. I'm telling you, man. The second one is so much better. The second one.
I gotta be honest, I've never seen the second one because of the reaction everybody had.
The second one is ballsy because it fucking kills off its leads, which I'm like, dude, that is fucking nuts. And secondly, there are no CGI jogging suits from space or whatever the fuck was going on in that shit ass sequence.
Whoa.
I'm sorry. I can't fucking stand that sequence. It to me is the epitome of why you don't just make everything CG. Nothing is grounded. Nothing has any kind of dimension or spatial relationship. It is just fucking watching a screensaver for 20 minutes. And I'm like, no, I'm completely checked out. The second one does a lot of really cool shit. And I am fully on board. Plus, The Rock. I'm sorry. You put The Rock in a sequel. I'm going to watch that sequel. I'm going to love that sequel. That's exactly what happened. So I am all for retaliation over Rise of Cobra. And don't fucking at me. That's all I'm going to say.
Fucking at him, guys.
Don't do
it. Seriously, you guys know more about movies than he does. We've learned that the hard way. So I think you should definitely at him and tell him what you think about his hot take. That is the hottest of takes.
I'm just saying, like, Stephen Sommers at this time already had signed on to reboot The Mummy. He was going to reboot The Mummy and King Kong simultaneously. That's nuts.
Yeah, he's got an odd. Let's go through Sommers real quick, because he made a small indie film for $800,000. Can't hold that against him. Maybe you've heard of it. It's called Catch Me If You Can.
Oh, with Leonardo DiCaprio.
No, it's the other
one.
No,
I know.
He did The Adventures of Huck Finn.
Which I watched a lot as a kid for some unexplained reason.
Because the, God, what's the name of the guy? Janos is, who's the cinematographer of that? That was the guy that did Cool as Ice and then went off to work with Spielberg for the rest
Are you life. Fucking shitting me?
No.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, what's his name?
You
know who I'm talking about.
Fuck.
Spielberg's guy.
Spielberg's guy, yes.
Yeah, everybody out there's going, it's this.
They're and screaming at us right
brain
now.
Brain fart after sheath, 3 years.
Sheathe your so tweets, guys.
but he did The Jungle Book, and that they're like, hey, you'd be good with fun monster movies. And he did Deep Rising, The Mummy Returns. That's where things get weird, because then he did Van Helsing.
Yeah.
That didn't go so well.
No, but again, I think you've kind of hit the nail on the head with him. About the 30s sensibilities.
He directed The Revenge of the Mummy, The Ride, which I'm only mentioning that because for those of you that are Defunctland fans, that is apparently one of the greatest rides of all time that existed for only like 2 years and then it got rebranded and was just like, if you were one of those magical people who got to go on that ride, you rode one of the greatest rides of all time.
Janusz Kaminski.
Janusz Kaminski.
By the way, speaking of rides, when he's on the Wave Runner outrunning the tentacles, I'm like, where is the fucking Disney ride for this? Because I would have been in line every goddamn day to ride that ride.
So he then did G.I. Joe, The Rise of Cobra. And then he did a movie I like that nobody's fucking seen called Odd Thomas.
Oh, yeah. With Anton Yelchin?
Yeah. It's an Anton Yelchin movie. It's a cool, weird fucking movie that is very, very in the vein. It's based on a book series. But it's a...
Man, we lost out when we didn't get more from Anton. Like, it fucking bums me out.
Yeah, no, we definitely got screwed out of a great actor. It was a tough thing. Somebody recently asked, they're like, if you could bring back an actor for one final great performance, what would it be? And it was between Heath Ledger and Anton Yelchin.
Yeah.
And I ended up siding with Yelchin or Ledger, but man, Yelchin is just, man, we were doing a couple of other great things. Like he was still baby faced. Like what would happen when that guy got a little age in his face? Yeah. Like what kind of performances would we have gotten?
There's part of me that hopes that if they continue on the Star Trek universe as it is now, that they'll just kind of give him the Reliant and he's off doing that. You know what I mean? Like they're not going to recast it. They're not going to try and explain it away. He's the captain of his own ship now, much like he was at the beginning of Wrath of Khan, and that's all there is to it. This movie is so fucking fun. It is so fun, and it's so well constructed in terms of its characters and the dialogue and just all of the tropes that it's bringing back from Alien and Aliens that you forgive all of the, you know, in my case, I forgive all of the CG. I don't even care. Like, I recognize the CG is not good. It does not fucking bother me. because the rest of that movie is so goddamn fun.
I think it works, especially for its era. It's actually really good for its era.
It's, you know what it's better than? Ghost Ship. It's better than the CG in Ghost Ship by leaps and bounds.
By a country fucking mile.
By a country finger basket. It is better than the effects of Ghost Ship. And if nothing else, it can definitely take that away. But just, you know, we talk all the time about sort of the alternate universe of film, and I just cannot stop thinking about the fact that we almost had a new King Kong cinematic universe, much in the way that we're getting those monsters coming back to the screen now in the early 2000s. And that's why there's, you want to talk about really believing in that, putting that fucking ending on a movie that has nothing to do with King Kong or Godzilla or anybody else, just fucking taping that shit to the end of Deep Rising. You believed in that for a time as a studio. You were like, yeah, we are pot committed. And then what were the what were the grosses on Godzilla? Really?
Well, keep in mind,
we were almost committed to this.
And also, it must be stressed, this is the mid to late 90s, and the mid to late 90s were a hot mess for Hollywood. Hollywood had no idea what the fuck it was doing.
Not just Hollywood Pictures, but Hollywood in general.
Hollywood in general just didn't know what the fuck it was doing. That era is so rough. There's a reason why we don't talk a lot about a lot of the movies from that time, and it's not because it's too fresh. It's because that is a rough patch. It's a very real rough patch where Hollywood started losing its way and indie films took over and we started getting all of these great indie films. And there's a smattering of good Hollywood movies in there, but the indie directors are really kind of dominating the marketplace. And it wasn't until 99, which we'll get to this summer, where the studios just said, well, here, we're just going to throw, you know, money at random things and just give it a shot, and started getting some incredible returns with crazy pants stuff. And it wasn't until 99 that we saw things kind of wind back in, and then started the creation of the era that is winding down now of this modern golden age of genre filmmaking. But in this era, they had no idea what they were doing, and they were just kind of throwing shit at the wall to see what sticks, and very little of it stuck. There's only a couple of really memorable things from that era that are big mainstream films. And so it doesn't surprise me that they were thinking of, well, fuck it. If they're rebooting Godzilla, why not King Kong? We haven't made that since 76. Fuck it.
Yeah, I guess what just surprises me is how it snuck up on the... It's like a secret King Kong movie. It's much in the same way that when you watch Split, right?
Yeah.
You watch Split and you're like, I'm sorry, what is this setting? What universe is this? Really? That kind of shit.
I still remember how you left. You left before the ending of that.
Yeah, I left before the end.
You had no idea, and I had explained to you what you had just watched.
That's what I'm talking about. You don't fucking get secret movies anymore. You don't get, like, you never see a movie about, like, a detective tracking down a serial killer, and then before the 5 minutes before the credits, Batman shows up. You don't get secret franchise movies like that. And that's what was so impressive to me about the ending of this movie, is you're like, oh, this is a fucking King Kong movie the whole time? What?
Which is kind of crazy in what they did with Skull Island.
Yes, exactly.
The moment of Skull Island where Jordan gives us this scene where we're seeing all this stuff in the cave, and we're seeing images of Godzilla and Mothra, and what they are setting up there is the movie we're about to play.
Do you know what's really fucked up is I'm pretty sure you had to tell me about that too. I'm pretty sure I turned off Kong Skull Island before that.
I wasn't going to bring it up to kick you in the balls again, but that is exactly what
happened. I am really bad at this. Because I don't expect secret movies. I don't, like, because of the era we're in now, I expect there to be 500 think pieces about where this franchise is going. And, like, there are no surprises anymore because the internet.
Well, that's the crazy thing is, weirdly, there's been a wonderful shift in the film community. Everybody shuts the fuck up. I did not get to see Into the Spider-Verse until 3 weeks after it came out. And walking in, I had no idea who the villains were.
I still don't know.
I had not heard word one of which Spider-Man villains show up, if any at all. Because you know what? Not in the fucking trailer.
I take that back. Do you know why I know?
Because I told you the beginning of this movie.
No. The reason I know is because I have kids. And when you shop for toys for kids, you know who all the characters are in any given fucking movie because toys.
Because toys.
Because toys. Yeah. But yeah, Deep Rising is just one of my deep fried favorites. It's like of all the weird sort of derelict craft movies that are ripping off Alien, it's one of my absolute favorites. And that is a stacked fucking subgenre.
Yeah.
Like we've proved it in
a subgenre.
Where's the one on the sub? Isn't there one on the sub? Isn't it called Below?
Well, the Below is, oh my God, isn't it called Below? Below is a haunted submarine movie, and it's fucking amazing.
I haven't seen it, but I'm aware of it.
Oh, we're covering that. I'm telling you. You have, the whole reason you've never mentioned it before is because you've not seen it. Oh, you're going to watch it, and you're going to go, we're covering that. So take a big old drink, junkie. Sometime this year, we're covering Below. David Tuohy's submarine masterpiece.
Below. Okay, but then can we also cover The Perfect Getaway if we're just in the David Tuohy universe? Because I really want to talk about The Perfect Getaway.
I kind of like The Perfect Getaway.
I really like The Perfect Getaway.
Okay. Outstanding.
Outstanding. Fucking Timothy Olyphant Terminators.
Dude, you really have to twist my arm hard to get me to talk about a Timothy Olyphant.
This is true. This is true. It's the Olyphant in the room. That you will cover any of his movies.
Can we turn that into a month? Is there a month that will go great, like Julephant or
the Olyphant in the Room is the name of that series.
All of February.
Yes, all of this, Olyphant of this, all of it. I am so on board for. I'm here for it. We'll even sneak
April,
a Josh Duhamel movie.
April-a-fant.
Here's the thing: is we sneak a Josh Duhamel movie in there and see if anyone notices.
No. Because you'd have to actually find a good Josh Duhamel movie.
Yeah, that's like finding a needle in a haystack that has no needles.
Someone out there is going, no, he's really good in this, and I'm not thinking what it is.
No, it's fine.
Like, I do enjoy him in the first Transformers movie, and the fact that the first Transformers movie and the second half of the third Transformers movie are the only Transformers movies I like.
Have you been hearing people talk about how good Bumblebee is?
I have.
I'm kind of interested.
I'm very interested. I just haven't had a chance to get there yet.
As much as I hate all of those sequels so fucking much. Like, the second Transformers movie is one of the most racist things I've seen since Birth of a Nation.
It's also got a giant fucking Devastator with
testicles.
With testicles. Like, it's like, really?
Because
Michael
Bay literally trying to sell that movie to people who put that shit on the back of their trucks. Like, fuck you, Michael Bay. The end of this episode about Deep Rising. Stargrove. Sorry about that, guys. We're going to go ahead and wrap this episode up. Thank you so much for joining us for this deep dive into Deep Rising.
I thought we were in the mailbag for a second.
we just did it. Riff, 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 riff.
What we're talking about. We're just...
This is what we do, folks. And if you're on board for that, I suggest you follow us on Twitter at Junk Food Cinema. Like the podcast on Facebook, facebook.com/junkfoodcinema. And if you really like the show...
Really like the show.
If you like the show as much as we don't like the substitute or the principal, you can go to patreon.com/junkfoodcinema. For as little as $1 an episode, you get access to bonus content no one gets to hear. For $25 an episode, if you commit for 4 episodes, you actually get to tell us what to cover. And that today is exactly what happened. So I want to thank Sean Nolan once. Oh, wait, no, that was last week.
No. Hold on.
Sam Gregory, excuse me. I want to thank Sam Gregory again.
Thanks, Sam.
For making Deep Rising happen. I'm so excited we got to talk about it. Cargill, where can people find you on the interwebs?
You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Massawyrm. That's MASSAWYRM. And you can find my creative writing podcast, 10 to 20 minutes a week. That's all. Along with Dave Chen over at
WriteAlongPod.com
or WriteAlongPodcast.com. One of the two. I know we're WriteAlongPod on Twitter.
It's good that I know your stuff better than you do. That's...
I try not to self-promote too much.
Oh, wait, were you serious?
Yeah, a little bit. Not so much. Where do they find you, Brian?
Oh, you can find me on Twitter at BryGuySalisbury. You can also find me at Junk Food Cinema on the Twitterverse. And I want to end this episode. It's done. And as Treat Williams would say...
Whoa.
Oh, we didn't do the junk food pairing, did we? Well, that brings us to the junk food pairing.
Where the fuck are we?
Point of fucking order.
Calamari, hello.
Fried calamari, literally written in my notes. So you and I are...
It's a trap!
It's not Olyphant, it's Duhamel! It's a trap!
Good night, everybody.
Oh, Jesus Christ. Good night.